So the government argued to the judge that we believe that Mr. Mitnick might have some national security information that's encrypted. We believe that he should provide the key. And once he gives us the key to that material, we'll give him all the discovery. And my attorney is thinking, and I go to my attorney, no, I'm not giving up my PGP key, sorry. So at the end of the day, the judge wasn't interested in the issue. It was a novel issue at the time. Can they force someone to give up their right against self-incrimination in exchange to getting access to the evidence for a fair trial? The judge basically said, Mr. Mitnick's very clever in encrypting his materials. Unless he gives the government the key, I'm not going to order the government to turn over the discovery. To make a long story short, after about 4.5 years of fighting the case, the government approached my attorney and said, listen, if your client wins at trial, what we're going to do is we're going to put him on the bus. And I go to my lawyer, I go, what's the bus? And he goes, the bus is where they just simply put you on a bus to another federal jurisdiction to face more charges. I go, how can they do that? That's double jeopardy. He goes, no. And he explained to me, they didn't charge you with all the possible accounts. If you hack into one system, but you make 5 phone calls that cross state lines to do it, that's 5 different counts. And they can indict you either at the terminating point or the origination point. So they can do it. So I was basically given a choice, an offer I couldn't refuse. Accept the government's offer or go through a revolving door of trials. And if you accept the government's offer, you'll be out in 10 months. If you don't accept the government's offer, there'll be no light at the end of the tunnel. So I decided in 1999 to finally accept the government's offer. And a lot of people ask me, what was prison like? Well, to sum it up, it was boring. It was depressing. It wasn't dangerous like you'll see on a movie like America Me, because I was in federal custody. But it was like a helpless feeling of not knowing what's going to happen with your future for years. I'm not talking about months or days or weeks, but for years, basically serving out a federal prison sentence before you're even convicted. I used to spend most of my time in the law library trying to find cases to assist my lawyer. My lawyer was a publicly appointed attorney, so his time was very limited. I would talk to friends, I'd talk to my family, I'd talk to different lawyers, I'd talk to supporters, which brings me to the Free Kevin movement. I have a deep gratitude for everyone who has shown me support over the years. I mean, I used to get letters. I even got to the point where I'd get so much mail that they would have to print it out. Friends would print out the email and send it to me in custody. And then what would happen is the prison wouldn't allow me to receive this mail because they thought it was written in secret code. So I try to find out what the secret code is, and they would see the MIME headers. Because you're sending a MIME-compliant message to a non-compliant system. And they'd see the MIME headers, and they'd go, oh, this is secret code. We can't let them have it. So the Free Kevin movement really helped me, besides my family, helped me get through this very tough time in my life, not knowing what was going to happen to me. I was, you know, pretty scared because of the rumors and the myths that were created about me in the press. And I decided I'm not going to get really into John Markoff during this talk because I think everybody has heard it and they can go and read my forbidden chapter on the internet. But I do want to tell one funny story that happened in prison. It's kind of funny now, but it wasn't funny then. I was at the law library, as I did every time I can get time in the law library. I'd go down and look at cases to assist in my defense. And I was taken back up to the housing unit, and they wouldn't let me in, and I see that they're taking everything out of my room, and they're packing everything up. And I go, what's going on? They go, you're going to the hole. I go, why am I going to the hole for? You're a security threat. And in my cell, they found contraband. After they decided to search it for the security threat, they found 74 cans of tuna. You weren't allowed to have these metal cans because you can take it and use it as a shank. But I used to, you know, buy these cans from the sentence inmates, and you're not allowed to have one can, but I concealed all these cans like in Ritz cracker boxes and Pop-Tart boxes. And they were all there in front of them, but so much in front of them they never saw them. But if they found them, they would just take them. So at first they said, oh, we caught you with contraband. And then eventually when my attorney got to the bottom of it, this was what happened. He actually talked to the warden's assistant. And the warden's assistant told him, well, the reason we put Mr. Mitnick in solitary, I was in there for another week, was because we had information that that we thought he was going to modify his AM/FM Walkman radio to become a transmitter and bug the warden's office. Now, the warden's office was outside the security perimeter of the prison. So I would actually have to break out, plant the bug, and go back into prison. But what really takes the cake is there was a group out from 2600 magazine that came out to picket in front of the prison, right? And we're holding a big Free Kevin banner. And somebody was bold enough to take a Free Kevin bumper sticker and stick it on the glass outside the prison to one of the doors. So later on that night, these like four lieutenants come to the room and they barge in. How did you do it? I'm good, aren't I? These guys watch too much MacGyver. Let's talk a little bit about the federal sentencing guidelines, and I'll be brief here. Is the loss that I allegedly caused a lot of my victims was really exaggerated by the federal government, because to really make me an example and give me the longest prison sentence possible, the loss, the amount of damages that are caused, largely reflect what type of sentence a person will get. So what the FBI did is they solicited the companies that were involved in my case to say that I caused the loss exceeding at least $80 million in each case. And those loss letters were eventually published by 2600 Magazine, and the prosecutors were so upset that they tried to get the judge to hold my attorney in contempt of court for releasing this information. But pretty much the beans were spilled and there was nothing they can do. And what they did, what the government's theory is, because don't forget, attorneys, all they have is arguments. So they wanted to come up with a theory or an argument to convince a federal court judge that I caused these atrocious losses. And the only way they were able to do it is what I did is I got into a lot of different companies that developed either operating systems or cell phones. And what I would do is I'd look at the source code. Because if you remember in the beginning of my talk, I was interested in becoming the best at circumventing security, and I wanted to look at the source. So what the theory the government used was nobody can buy the source code. It was the company's crown jewels. Even though Kevin didn't distribute it, sell it, or intend to use it, he still looked at it. And so we believe that companies like Motorola, companies like Novell, companies like SGI had lost their initial R&D investment in the source code, right? For me, just looking at it. It's like getting a pirated copy of a Steven Spielberg movie before it's released and watching it. Oh, and now you're responsible for millions of dollars that it took to make the movie. And what ended up happening is in signing my plea agreement, I just said I caused a loss between $5 and $10 million just to settle the case. The government said in their press releases it exceeded $300 million. At the end of the day, the restitution that I had to pay back was $4,125. If the loss was $4,125, I would have served no prison time on the sentencing guidelines. So another interesting issue of the loss is all the companies that were involved in my case were publicly traded corporations. And under Rule 12G, Securities and Exchange Commission, anytime a business suffers a material loss, you have to report it to your shareholders so they can make best decisions on whether they want to continue investing in your company. So my defense team pulled the 10-Ks and 10-Qs, had a research company research their public disclosures thoroughly, and not one of these companies had ever attributed any loss to me in their 10-Ks or 10-Qs. So that was kind of interesting. So I always like the old Wendy's a slogan, you're like, where's the beef? And the truth of the matter is, I'm sure my activities did cause some of these companies some loss. I don't know what that number was. I don't think it even approaches anywhere near a half $1 million. But my argument is I should have been punished based on the actual losses that I caused rather than these fictitious numbers that the government tried to bandy about to put me in prison for as long as possible. Because I was the deterrent. I was the guy kind of pinned up on the cross to deter all of you from hacking. So I just want to go over really quick, what are my lessons learned from my experience? One lesson learned is, and I know Carrie's here in the audience, she's my webmaster, is you don't ask your webmaster to pull the judge's financial records to find out if she was a shareholder in any of the companies that you were indicted. Because what had happened is one day I show up at court, and I had a bright idea. I go, well, this judge really hates me, so let's try to get her off the case. I'm thinking, well, a lot of companies are big-name companies that were involved in my case. If she's invested, if she had any stock or her husband has any stock, I can get her off my case. Brilliant idea, right? Wrong. What happened is the federal judiciary reported it to the judge that somebody from 2600 Magazine requested her financials. So when I showed up in court that day, she was more than livid. That was a big surprise to me, right? So I'm in court, she goes, Mr. Randolph, who's 2600? And I'm thinking, God, what happened? And she goes, she told the story that somebody had requested her financials. She thinks that that I'm behind it. And if anything happens to her credit rating or financial standing in the community, that Mr. Mitnick is somehow involved. Bad thing to piss off your sentencing judge. Not good. Don't do it. Next thing, FBI has no sense of humor. Not at all. In fact, with the Eric Hines thing, remember what I said about getting the phone number of that one phone number that belonged to the undercover agent, Joseph Ways? Is what I started doing is I started pulling not only the bills for that telephone number, but every number that called, any cellular phones that were called, I also pulled those bills. And I was able to determine the cell phone number of every agent on the white collar crime squad number 3 in L.A., that of the L.A. Bureau. Actually, like I had pins in a map with their phone numbers. Then I bought this device called a DDI from this guy, Mark, in Milwaukee. And what this DDI device is, you attach it to your computer, and you can monitor the forward control channel of the cell sites in your area. So what I did is I programmed all the FBI agents' phone numbers in this little software configuration menu. So anytime those agents would be in the area, they'd have to, your phone goes in the area, it registers, I see you register. And one day I'm at work and I hear beep, 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 beep. And I go and look at this menu. Oh, Agent McGuire's around. I'll leave him donuts when he comes searches in a couple days because that's the only reason he's here. But, I'll tell you one funny thing about the search. I was really, really tired. This wasn't done on purpose. And 2 days later, after the beep, 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 first of all, I got rid of all the contraband that I had. And at 6 in the morning, somebody's trying my door. No knock, just trying the door, like a key trying to get in. And like immediately, just reactive, I get out of bed, and I sleep nude, for all you that are interested. And and I open the door, and there's a female FBI agent standing there. I go, hi, how can I help you? Yep. I wasn't even thinking. I wasn't wearing anything because I was so, like, shocked. But then I realized, I go, oh, no, can I put some clothes on? Hey, my journey through this, through the mirrors, I guess, or through the justice system and my experiences of, I kind of was a hacker for the sheer entertainment value and the quest for knowledge, the pursuit of knowledge, the intellectual challenge, the thrill of being somewhere where I really shouldn't be, kind of like exploring that abandoned house on the corner when you're not allowed to go there. And that was kind of my mindset. And back in the early days, hacking was a lot, well, there's a little bit of a dynamic here. Hacking, in some respects, was easier but in some respects harder. Back then, there was no tools. You didn't have Nessus, you didn't have Nmap, you didn't have a lot of these tools that you could use to, you know, possibly compromise the system. You did everything by hand. And back in those days, security was really lax. You know, security is really an afterthought. People are really reactive instead of proactive. So what's changed today is you don't even have to know how these exploits or how to analyze a system really works under the hood. You can go download the tools that are prepackaged for you. All you have to do is know how to point and click, know what an IP address is in some cases. But at the same time, it's a little bit harder because businesses, government agencies, and educational institutions are aware of the security threat, so they try to raise the bar, right? And I want to encourage, you know, all of you out there that not to follow in my footsteps. I think I'm extremely lucky to be honored enough to stand here before you all and address you. I kind of, you know, it's kind of unbelievable. Like, you know, at the Last Hope, I was on supervised release. I couldn't even touch a fax machine without permission. The one before that, I was in federal prison for already 3 years, and the one before that, I was a fugitive, right? And the path I took isn't the path to take. So we as hackers might decide we want to compromise a system because it's fun, but unfortunately the person on the other side of that attack doesn't know your intentions, and they freak out, and they spend a lot of money and time trying to figure out who you are, what you did, and how to keep you out. So at the end of the day, you are costing somebody some cash, and that's not a good thing. And today, you can get the same excitement, the same thrill, the pursuit of knowledge, the same thrill of being somewhere where you shouldn't really be, and the pursuit of knowledge legally by being a hacker for hire. Now you can take your skills and be a pen tester, do security assessments. Of course, you have permission, but a lot of times, the person that gives you permission, they won't tell anybody else in the organization that you're testing. So you still get that, like, Mission Impossible type of attack scenario. So the motto is, rather than, hack and possibly affect your life in a negative way and end up serving some time, you could hack in a way that's socially productive and where you earn some money at the end of the day. And one thing I do want to say before closing is how I found myself, I think, in this position is back when I was in high school. Remember I got that A? For writing, I got an A for writing that program that stole the teacher's password. Today, if you did the same thing, you'd be expelled. So back in my day, they didn't teach any computer ethics. Ethics, it was okay. You were considered to be the whiz kid or the gifted person or the genius if you can do these types of things, these phone freaking type of activities and this hacking type of stuff. And you were given the attaboys or the pats on the back. So back in my day, maybe if they had an ethics program or the instructors at school taught some computer ethics, maybe I would have taken a different path. And there's another well-known speaker who speaks on issues of security, mainly check fraud, and his company did a survey of all the different high schools throughout the country and asked the question to high school students, is it okay to break into your fellow student's account? And this was recently done, and 48% said yes, it's okay. So if people are of that mindset, well, hell, people are going to continue to hack. So maybe it's a question of ethics. I want to go ahead and leave some time for open Q&A. You're going to have to speak up because I'm a little bit hard of hearing. Because when I was in prison for those 4.5 years, I used to listen to my Walkman all the time, and I used to crank up the music to escape the physical place that I was at, and I think I screwed up my hearing a little bit. So I want to thank everybody for being here today. Once again, I want to especially thank Emmanuel Goldstein and everyone from 2600. It's finally great to be at my first Hope. And I'm going to ask 4 trivia questions because I brought presents. I think they're back there if you can get them. I brought four of my books, The Art of Deception. I'm going to ask 4 Mitnick trivia questions. If you get it right, you get a free book. How about that? All right? Thank you. Done. All right. Well, let me think of a good question. I don't have these pre-planned. Okay. What was my favorite operating system? Anybody? Hey, raise a hand. Who said VMS? Come down. You got it. Come on down. Where is he? All right. All right. The lights are in my eyes. I'm sorry. So what's another good trivia question? Let me think. What's the first... I said this in my talk, so I'll see how much you guys are paying attention. What's the first... or what type of computer terminal did I use when I was in high school? What? Olivetti right there. Come on. You got it. All right. Thanks. What's a good question, Darcy? When's the last time I hacked into your system? No. What? Just kidding. Let's see. Should have prepared these ahead of time. When? Yeah. Help yourself. Thank you. When? What is the month, day, and year I was finally able to get back on the internet? Anyone raise their hand? No, the month, day, and year. You? Not 13. No? Anybody else? The day I was able to use the internet again. Yeah, you got it.
Thank you.
All right. Now, this is for the watchers of the Screensavers program. What's the first website I went to when I was finally allowed to use the internet? Who? No, not Google. Not 2600. Not free Kevin. My girlfriend, you got it. Labmistress.com. All right. So I'm going to open up to Q&A, and feel free to ask any question you would like. And you probably want to come up to the microphone so I could hear you. And I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. Does that microphone work? Okay.
Kevin, do you see any technological solution to the social engineering problem? Something we can add onto our phone system, something we can do using this technology to stop it?
Well, the question, the question is there any technology that can stop social engineering? I look at it more as like a defense in depth thing. Like, for instance, a social engineering attack is to send a target, like, for an example, an attachment that contains some malicious code. So if they're running some AV software that catches it after they followed through on the attack, that might stop the attack from succeeding. So you got AV software. The other issue is design. A lot of customer service centers could look up private customer information, and how they verify who you are is by asking a password or a social security number, mother's maiden name. A lot of times the rep could see that right on their screen. It creates a target-rich environment where you can trick the rep into revealing that information. So if they design the system that if a customer called in and the rep asked what your password was, and then the rep had to key it in and the system actually did the comparison, that would create a more secure environment. So that's another area where technology could be used.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Come up to the mic if you want to ask any questions.
No, I'll make it out of your way.
Hey, Kevin. Glad to see that that you made it out. I hope this doesn't get you into trouble or anything, but could you whistle that whole nuke thing for us here?
Yes. You know, I don't think I'm still in tune. But I'll practice. Maybe I'll have the launch CD.
And
there you go.
Do the close encounter CD. They'll never know the difference.
Yeah. They changed the code. I can't whistle it anymore. I'm sorry.
Oh, the old one, then.
Any other questions? Come on up, Dan.
Was it really you who left those messages on Susumu Shimamura's voicemail?
Oh, no. In fact, that guy is now, I think, an employee at NetSec. I never met him, but it wasn't me. There was some voicemail messages that were left on Shimamura's machine coincidentally at the same time that JSZ and I attacked his computer system. And And it was kind of funny because once we got into his machine, we were interested in looking at the stuff that he was doing with the Oki 900, him and a guy named Mark Lauder. And Shimomura dumped an image of his firmware, which included the stuff in memory, and were able to find out the codes that he had for his answering machine and for his office. The codes were right there because he saved it in his phone's memory. And so JSZ, we're on a three-way. He's at a payphone in Beersheba, Israel. I'm in, I think, Denver, Colorado at the time. And I three-way in Shimomura's office machine, and I put in the code to retrieve his messages, and we hear the same messages. And we're thinking, were we somehow logged? Was somebody watching us do this, and did they leave those messages? Because it was like coincidentally within minutes. So, but no, I had nothing to do with it. But the guy that actually did it actually called him and left the messages after I was arrested in the same voice. You know? So I guess his kung fu is the best.
One quick one. Is it true at one point you actually had your own long-distance 10X code?
No. But I did have my own in Pac Bell in Southern California. They had special phone numbers, a special prefix for the phone company. They were 811 numbers. So any employee that knew they would dial an 811 prefix, it'd be an internal number. So what I did is I had my own 811 number so I could be any department within the phone company.
Okay, because be aware there was a recording floating around years ago that apparently, maybe it was well faked, but apparently it showed somebody dialing a 10X code and a mesh came up. But instead of saying the name, it came up with your name in the usual bell voice. And
oh, thank you for using Kevin Mitnick?
Yeah, that thing, yeah.
Yeah, the real lady that did the AT&T recordings did that recording for a friend of mine.
So basically it was fake, in other words. Okay, I'm just curious.
But no, she really did. It was really her voice. Her name was Pat.
Yeah, but I'm saying, so, but the fact you didn't actually have a code set up. It was just a fake
No,
thing.
That was a fake thing.
That's what I was curious.
Right. Myth. Yeah, just a myth.
For years, so.
But what we did do is we figured out how we could intercept directory assistance for Rhode Island. So whenever a customer would call in, I got to play telephone operator.
Let me guess, Tone D.
Tone D, exactly. And after we worked that out, some unsuspecting customer would call and they'd go, what city? Oh, we'd say, what city? And say, Providence. How can I help you, ma'am? They'd ask for a listing. And we'd say, oh, by the way, we're doing a survey. Do you have a white pages or yellow pages at the home? And, oh, yes, we do. Oh, by the way, are you at home now? Oh, yes. Why are you calling me? Yeah. Yeah, to the point of, yes, ma'am, that number is 555-21537. What? 555-21537. Well, how do you dial a half? Oh, you didn't get the new phone. Yeah. So the phone company shut that down in a day. Yeah. But it was fun.
Do you think you've had more effect on the hacker culture as a martyr or as a deterrent?
I don't know. That's a good question. Martyr or deterrent? I think I don't think I was much of a deterrent because if you go to cybercrime.gov and you look at all these hacking cases that were after me, I think a lot of people have heard of the case, and they're probably extra careful that they don't do things that could, where they could land up in the same place that I was. You know, and hopefully that won't happen today. If somebody does commit some sort of hacking type crime, hopefully the government can't pull the wool over the federal judiciary's eyes like they did in my case. So hopefully I was able to create the sense of awareness to help everybody out there so they don't become the next Kevin Mitnick in that regard.
Well, at least we have you for a precedent.
What?
At least we have you for a precedent.
Yeah, that's right, the precedent, yeah. Got rude, I like your shirt.
Oh, thanks. Hey, Kevin, I had a question. Dealing with all this stuff, you know, psychologically and mentally, now that it's over with and you're getting on with your life, what plans and what things are you looking forward to nowadays to make up and rebuild what you've lost?
Well, my short-term goals are I'm working on a new book, and I do want to mention that to everybody. I'm working on this new book called The Art of Intrusion, which is a kind of a sequel to The Art of Deception. And this is going to be different. It's not going to be about social engineering. It's going to be about the innovative, the sexy, the clever, the most interesting hacks in cyberspace, where either the target was particularly interesting or where the attacker used maybe a blended attack I'm not talking about something that was simply downloading exploit code and running it against a target. I'm something that took some thinking, took some creativity. And I'm still looking for people that would like to come forward and share their stories with me. In fact, the deadline is actually in a week, is the last time I'm accepting any stories. So if any of you would like to meet with me in private while I'm here at the conference, if you guys have any stories that you would like to share, that might, if it makes it into the book, we're paying $200. If it's the best story of all, we're paying $500. And to give you a sense of what the best story is so far, is we got these group of four guys that went to Las Vegas, and they became very interested in the video poker machines. They bought one, they took it back to New York, they reverse engineered the firmware in the machine, and they were able to develop another program that could find where in the sequence the pseudo-random number generator was, and they were able to get a royal flush. They would actually be able to get a royal flush in a certain amount of time. They could set their watches and know in 8 minutes and 36 seconds a royal was going to come up, and they took Vegas for hundreds of thousands of dollars and were never caught. Now, that's a really interesting story. So it's not, so that, you know, that's a different type of hacking. That's basically finding a flaw in the application. But I'm looking for social engineering, physical, wireless, technical. That's kind of innovative. And if you have a problem sharing your black hat stories, which I think are the most compelling, we all, if you're a pen tester, and you've used a very innovative and clever and interesting method that you're willing to discuss, I'm also interested in that too. But as far as your question of what I want to do, like in my future, is I want to continue to be a successful author, work as a consultant in this industry. I kind of put building my company, Defensive Thinking, on hold because I'm busy going around. I'm traveling a lot, doing a lot of talks in social engineering. We developed a two-day seminar on how to train companies to be less resistant to social engineering type of attacks.
So the benefit, probably now, the sharing of it and giving that awareness to somebody else is giving you a peace of mind and a benefit from what you've learned so far.
Yeah, well, basically, I'm taking what I know best, what I have a passion for technology, and trying to use it in a way that helps people and at the same time gives me that challenge, gives me that thrill, gives me that knowledge that hacking provided for me. Because that's what it provided for me was, again, it was sheer entertainment and this pursuit of knowledge, wanting to know how things worked. You know, and today, unfortunately, the media has changed the term to hacker to mean somebody that's a criminal that uses a computer to steal credit card numbers, for example, which is really unfortunate for us all.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Good to see you, Kevin.
Hey, thank you for coming.
After following the story of your life and reading your book and hearing this hearing your speech today, it's painfully obvious that people in non-technical positions in corporations have some access to information that is technical and could cause problems with security that they may not even realize the scope of whatever it is, whatever that one little piece of information that they possess.
The mosaic
how vital
theory.
It could be. Now, do you believe that the solution to this sort of a situation would be to hire technical people, even for non-technical positions, people who have a hacking background, who understand these things already, even for, say, an accounting position or a human resources position or a secretary, for instance? Or do you feel simply that social engineering training after you hire an employee or other training in these technical skills is sufficient to curtail this problem?
Well, first of all, I think the most important thing is to kind of change your corporate culture and get people to internalize that security is important. Because if they don't internalize that behavior, it's basically based on external forces like your boss watching you or management watching you. Then as soon as management isn't watching, they basically revert back to what they want to do anyway. So the first major step is getting to internalize that security is an important part of their job. And then secondly, giving them a kind of an education of how it works. What are the methodologies, the tactics, and strategies that social engineers use? And the most common thing that people are aware of is the Nigerian scam, because everyone's been the target of it. And once they have kind of the general framework of how social engineering works, then you can put them through some sort of resistance training. It's kind of like inoculation, in a sense, where you try to inoculate them by using certain methods. So they're more aware and more less likely to circumvent security protocol, because at the end of the day, the attacker wants to convince his or her target to circumvent security protocol. It's really a challenge where you have organizations that don't have a security protocol. They don't have written policy. So if you don't have a policy, you have nowhere to start. And so sometimes it really, they have to build this from the ground up. But putting technical people with like a technical background doing mundane work, I don't think would really work. They'd probably be bored with their position. I don't think it's really necessary. It might be like if they're an accountant, having the technical skills might help them with Excel. But I don't think it's really, you have to go to those extremes. I think that once people are introduced to what social engineering is, once they're inoculated, once they understand the methods and tactics that are used, once they can distinguish between what's a legitimate request and what is a manipulative request, it raises the bar. Because unfortunately, you can't inoculate everybody. There's always going to be somebody that thinks they operate under the illusion of invulnerability and they can't be tricked. So another first step is demonstrating that everybody's vulnerable. And you do that by burning them. And once they're burned, you know, in a positive way, then they're more likely to learn their lesson. If that makes sense to you.
Yes, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome.
I just wanted to, can you touch upon the part where you were in North Carolina and they track you by a cell phone?
Okay, sure.
I mean, can you discuss the difference between back then and today's cell phone with the chip that has the GPS locator? I mean, can you explain how that works or how, like,
yeah, sure.
How the tracking and
well, how I was tracked, I was using the cell phone protocol that I was using was NAMPS, which is kind of old. That's I think they still have it in California, but pretty much it was analog cell phone systems. And what had happened is one of my first things I would do is when I would move into a different location, I'd immediately compromise the telecommunications infrastructure where I was living, so I'd have complete control. So as soon as I moved to Raleigh, I compromised GTE and had full access to all the switches there, and I think it was Southern Bell. And what I did is I modified the DMS switch so they couldn't do a trace on my calls. It would basically put it into a loop, into nowhere. So it really frustrated the government because they couldn't get nowhere on tracking me. So apparently Shimomura came up with a bright idea. Is based on what we believe Kevin would be calling, what internet service providers, why don't we do a terminating number search? And then we could locate the phone and the ESN that he's currently using. So that's precisely what they did, is I would call into NetCom, and they searched on all the POP numbers in the local switch in North Carolina, identified the number, then they found what cell tower that I was close to, and went out with a cell scope, and did RDF. And if you know anything about radio, you know, anything that was 800 megahertz range, it's pretty simple to do radio direction finding, and that's how I was identified. In today's world, the cellular systems have evolved in such a way, and now it's easier to track you, right? And I think AT&T has this friends and family feature, from what I remember, is if you want to know where you're...
No, that's MCI.
What? You're familiar with it? Yeah, so the friends and family is you can find out the GPS location of somebody that has authorized it. But an interesting thing is I think that could be abused, because remember when I was tracking the locations of the federal agents, I had access to AirTouch's network, of course, illegitimately, and there was a system called NMS. So I could basically, in real time, do an inquiry on a cell number, and it would tell me the last call, incoming, outgoing call, and actually give me the cell number that it was out of. So I'd look up at a chart, and I'd be able to see the physical location of that cell in real time. So I was able to track anybody on their network. But don't forget, this was a decade ago. So if that was possible a decade ago, you got to think of what's possible today. I think your cell phone is like a homing device for you. But maybe a better person to talk about wireless tracking technologies is Waz, so, since he's more familiar with that than I am.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.
Hi, Kevin. I've got a question about your ability to launch nuclear weapons.
Actually, it's not totally in jest. You prominently seem to have hacked or compromised commercial enterprises, companies.
True.
Seeing as how we now have the ability to talk via the internet to just about any country on the planet, do you think it's absurd at this point to be concerned about the ability of a hacker to launch nuclear weapons, given the government's ineptitude with most endeavors?
Well, I don't know about the U.S. government's controls or countermeasures, but I would have to assume that anything to do with these type of weapons of mass destruction aren't connected to any type of public network, like the public, public switch telephone network or anything. I think they're totally autonomous. That's my belief, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
I worked at the Pentagon for a year, and the secret network and the non-classified network were bridged frequently.
You're talking about CIPRNet?
Yes.
Oh, well, I mean, there's always that oversight, but just off the top of my head, you would think that it would be a no-brainer to not have any type of systems, SCADA systems or whatever, that are connected to any public networks that were attached to any of these type of devices. I just think it would be stupid. But then again, people do a lot of stupid things.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Just a comment on the stupid things with weapons of mass destruction. Throughout the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis and a lot of that period, the launch code for most, if not all, of America's nukes was
00000. thanks for that info.
I'll
have to whistle hex zeros now.
Probably the biggest challenge to technical and non-technical hackers is staying entertained and staying out of trouble. What advice do you have for up-and-coming hackers to make an honest living, or at least not too big a dent in their criminal record, and keep themselves occupied, entertained, and out of trouble?
Well, nowadays, which wasn't available back when I started, was now computer systems are affordable to anybody. I mean, I couldn't even buy a terminal, a VT100 terminal, if you remember those dumb terminals, for over $1,000. A Vedic triple 1200 baud modem was like $1,500. I couldn't afford it. Today, people can set up their own networks of running various different platforms. They can set up their own lab and try attacks in their own lab, and they're not affecting anybody else. Of course, the element of exploration, the element of being somewhere where you shouldn't be, is missing from that equation. But at least you're not affecting anybody else, and you're not going to hopefully end up in the can later.
Okay. Any career advice that you would give to anyone who's new to hacking and finds themselves talented at it?
Yeah, learn a lot about programming, learn a lot about debugging, analyzing code. I mean, I haven't done any coding in years, and I have to get back into it because, it's an important part of, testing for security failures is the ability to debug code.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah. Hey
there. As we've seen in your case and in other well-known cases with hackers, there seems to be a problem in the justice system from way over, blown out of proportion treatment and sentences to just maybe an overall ignorance of technology. And I was just wondering if you have any thoughts about that or see a solution for the justice system.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, there's been many cases that have been blown out of proportion. Mine, Kevin Polson, and the U.S. Attorney's Office in federal cases has an agenda, and part of that agenda is, I believe, prosecuting computer-related crimes more vigorously. So, and don't forget, the people that are also the prosecutors have their own agendas. They want to step up the stepping, they want to advance, in their career. And the more people they can put in the jail and the longer they can put them there, the more they advance in their career. And at the same time, you have the true believers that are doing it for truth, justice, and the American way because they believe it's the right thing to do. So it's really hard to stereotype, the prosecutors. But what I do have a problem with is things like the Patriot Act, things like life imprisonment for hacking. For example, I believe there was an amendment to, I forgot the statute, where you can get life imprisonment without the possibility of parole if you use a computer and you cause serious injury or death to another. So I had to ask myself the question, well, if you use another tool like a car or a hammer, do you get the same penalty? And the answer was no, at least in California. If you hit somebody with your car and kill them, of course, if it's not intentional, if it's reckless or negligent, you might get 3 or 4 years of manslaughter. How come if you used a computer and negligently or recklessly killed somebody or caused them injury, do you get life without the possibility of parole? So I think there's a big disparity between the types of punishment you can get based on the tool, and I don't think the tool should matter. The tool shouldn't matter. You've got to look at the result. What's the result, not the tool?
Yeah.
And it's all about that hocus pocus around computers, right? People are afraid still.
Yeah, there's a lot of fear.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
All right, thank you.
Hello.
Hey.
Okay, now my main question actually focuses on something that actually came to mind while I was listening to Bruce Schneider do his speech on security and as far as most of the trade-offs. Now, my main question is, since you've been doing the public speaking, showing other companies that, okay, this is how easy it is to go through and trick people using social engineering.
Right.
Now, what's to say that that you're actually getting through to them instead of, okay, we'll just pay to have you come by, do a speech, just make it look like we care, and then not actually hold anything accountable?
Well, you can't do it with one speech. What the speech is basically an entertaining, eye-opening experience mm-hmm. to really just make people aware of the problem. The way to hopefully train people in the company environment to resist social engineering is to put them through a security awareness training program mm-hmm. that's a lot more intensive, just hearing someone speak for about an hour.
Right.
And then actually testing them on their knowledge, and even in some situations, because every company is different on their mm-hmm. security needs, is actually performing an attack on your own people, kind of like social engineering pen testing, right. to see where your weaknesses are. And there's two sides to the message here, because there's been some recommendations that there's been some recommendations by some of the old timers. Oh, you shouldn't test your own security through social engineering because that's just going to decrease employee morale. It's going to piss a lot of people off. It's going to at the end of the day, affect your corporate culture. But I don't agree with that. I think that if companies they definitely should do the pen testing on the social engineering side as well as the technical side, but also that they should make their people aware that they might be subject to this type of testing, either when they're first hired into the company as part of their new employee orientation, or for existing employees, putting them on notice. Hey, to test our security, you might get a call, a social engineering attack, and we're doing this to increase our security, so we just want to give you a heads up that this is the type of testing we perform. And if people don't like it, well, they could choose to work there or they could choose not to.
Okay.
You know?
All right. And
there's a lot more to the subject. It's just like,
yeah,
I don't want to take everyone's time up on it.
Yeah, and I had a second part, which...
What's your second part?
Well, the second part was also by the same vein, even if they were to go through the tiger testing. Like, say, average Joe Schmo me decides to walk into a bank. I notice that there's something wrong with their procedure, or in the case of just waltzing past the x-ray machine, and I decide to point it out to them. Now, as far as, like, being labeled as a potential enemy combatant of the state, or not actually getting ignored, would there be any other approaches to solving such a problem so that it gets rectified, but by the same token, no one goes to jail or loses their head over it?
Yeah, I haven't really thought much about that. You're talking like if you're at an airport and you see a security failure that somebody can get by, like the security?
That or even in the company setting where you're
probably at the airport. Yeah, I mean, I think you're welcome to do that. You might miss your next flight, though. Mm-hmm. Might want to make your flight 2 or 3 hours later.
Right. But also, trust me, after riding Amtrak, that's not a problem.
I mean, I mean, I remember the kid that snuck the stuff on Southwest flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's facing or was convicted of federal charges. I wouldn't go that far to test their security, especially in an industry that right now is really paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
But if you see a security failure, I'd certainly try to notify them, maybe by email or by letter, maybe anonymously. Okay. Might be a good way, so that way you're not put on some no-fly list.
Right, but also, even if you were to go through such approach and they decide not to heed your advice, then...
Yeah, you could lead, what's the old saying? You could lead an animal to the water, but you can't make it drink.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
What? Yeah, Adrian Lamo comes to mind.
All right, yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Hi, this will be quick.
Okay, last question.
Yeah. Any possibility of you reviving your radio program you did on KFI?
Oh, KFI?
Or any place else?
I haven't thought about getting into talk radio again. I might do so in the future, but Leah Lepore now does a KFI show, and I recommend you listen to it. It's a great show. And hopefully one day I'll get back into talk radio. I really enjoy doing it. But I went on to different endeavors.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, just also quick, is there any possibility of those programs being made available on the Internet or an archive or, CD to buy or something?
I haven't really thought about that, but I'll run up my co-host, Alex, I think, has some copies on DVD. I might ask him about it if he could post it to the Internet. But then we got to find out if we have permission because they have commercials in there, stuff like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you for all the support, and I couldn't have done it without you. And I'll be here for the entire conference, and any of you are welcome to come up to me and talk to me. And again, anybody that's interested in the stories that has anything to contribute, please talk to me as well. Thank you very much, everyone.